Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris, and today our guest is Jason Porcillo. Jason is the Vice President of Operations at Edel Golf, LLC, reporting directly to the CEO. Viewed as a forward-thinking leader and catalyst for continuous improvement procedures, Jason is best known for his passion, energy, and ability to move the company forward through turnaround solutions, utilizing technology, and Kaizen principles. Jason inspires his team to think differently, believe, and deliver beyond what others think is possible. A decisive executive, Jason's success in optimizing business value and improving efficiencies has led to historic gains in building a world-class manufacturing entity and global order fulfillment business. With numerous industry accolades and collaborating on 11 company patents focused on innovative solutions, Jason's ability to visualize future success has set him apart from those merely satisfied with yesterday's accomplishments. Prior to Edel Golf, Jason honorably served 9 years in the United States Marine Corps as a chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear defense sergeant. As a decorated and distinguished military leader with a top secret security clearance, Jason presented sensitive situation briefs and subject matter expertise to executive staff. Welcome to the show, Jason. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Joe. Really excited to be here. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. You know, I've been following your goings on here for darn near a year, I would guess. And, you know, I love the story of Edel Golf. I never heard of it, of course, before I met you. And then I became quite intrigued. I mean, they have some really innovative approaches to the equipment that they make. So why don't you tell me a little bit about Edel and your role there?
Yeah, absolutely. So we, and like you said, I'm glad we finally got a chance to do this. It's taken quite some time to link up our schedules, but here we are. So Edel Golf is, we're definitely an outside the box thinking type of crew. We specialize in custom fit equipment, specifically putters, wedges, and irons. And through our custom experience, we ultimately make you a completely bespoke piece of equipment. So I specifically oversee the putter department and manufacturing side of the company. And through that, the way we are set up is we manufacture everything in-house through a machine shop that we own and operate. And it's all U.S. sourced material, most of it coming from a mill up in Pittsburgh and one of the last remaining golf companies to do so. But through our process, our fitting system alone, we can make over 1 million different combinations to ultimately whittle down to the exact specifications that you need for your equipment to make your perception reality.
So, I mean, that's... You know, in the continuous improvement world, we want to minimize variance, and you guys seem to be going the opposite way. So I'm not going to buy your equipment at like Dick's Sporting Goods, right? And I won't go up there to the Dick's Sporting Goods, you know, near where I used to live and say, hey, I want, you know, an Edel putter. I'm just not going to happen. Is that right?
Yes and no. So we have been in a retail scenario the last few years. It's definitely not our strong suit, though. What we specialize in is an actual experience that you're going to get from us through what we call either a regional fitter, which is a contractor for us, or in-house, obviously, as well, or a Greengrass account, which is your country clubs. Through our accounts, they're all trained up on our process. They're all master fitters for us. And they have each one of our systems, whether it be a putter, wedge, or iron system. And they will take you through the whole thing, soup to nuts, and get you dialed into what you need. So with the putter specifically, it's an aim and speed scenario that we're really focused on to get you dialed into eliminate your biases or your tendencies and get you completely squared up to where you need to be and feeling what you need to feel to make the ultimate piece of equipment for you and in turn, hopefully lower your scores.
Well, so the people out in the field, they're taking various measurements, you know, height, weight, ability, mobility might be one of them, and then feeding it into some ordering system, and it ships on down to Edel Golf in Liberty Hill, Texas. And what happens then? You get the order. Just walking through that a little bit, you know, to the extent that you can say anything.
Sure. So you're correct in that. We take all different variants into consideration. It all plays out in the process itself when you're going through the fitting experience. At that point, we are a global company. Our headquarters, like you said, here in Liberty Hill, Texas, about 45 minutes northwest of Austin. So when a fitter or an account of ours finishes their one-on-one with a client, they go to an online portal that we have and they submit it. And outside of a Saturday or Sunday, within 24 hours, we begin producing that model, that specific club that they fit into. And depending on the different combinations that go into it, is how it kind of breaks down. But it will start typically at the manufacturing level. We do carry a small inventory of stock heads, I guess you can call them, at our machine shop. And then based off of line combinations and other factors that play into it, they will finish up the kind of raw finish on it. And then it comes to our main building and we begin the rest of our process. The way we're currently set up right now, we do have a new line coming out here in about 27 days now. But the current line is our torque balance line. That's our award-winning one. And that goes through hand stamping, hand grinding. There's certain paint finishes that go on before it finishes up to where the true specs that you were fit into start to play out. And that's where we have all of our loft and lie machines. We have our different, there's scales all over the building. We're constantly checking weight. But the end goal that we're looking for what you were last holding in your hands during the fitting process is to be within plus or minus 1 single gram of what you last held. We are there 100% of the time, completely dialed in. And that's within head weight and handle weight as well for the speed portion.
So when I'm looking at the irons, you say you Edel makes irons also.
Correct.
Do you measure for each iron or do you sort of like take the first one and last one and extrapolate the middle?
No, we can do every single one. The fitting process is a bit more streamlined than that, but we have the ability to completely dial in every single club in your bag. And specifically with our more recent irons that we developed, which is our single length irons, we have a weight port in the back of the head now that within 2 gram increments between 2 and 14 grams, we can completely dial in every single iron in your bag now, which no one else in the industry can do right now.
So,
and if that dramatically affects your trajectory and your left to right ball flight as well.
So if I'm not mistaken, it was Lee Trevino that said that not even God could hit a one iron. So do you guys make a one iron too?
we've dabbled in it. it's not a it's not a mass produced item right now. That's more a customized thing. And it's not something we want to get too deep into either.
Yeah, I bet not. I bet not. So great. So you're the VP of operations and you have a passion for continuous improvement. When did you get this passion? I mean, when did you first recognize and say, you know what? I really like making things better.
So outside of the terminology itself, it's I've always had that mentality. I'm always trying to improve something somewhere in life itself. you know, whether it's studying more for a test or running faster with, you know, I ran track in high school, playing better for ice hockey or golf, whatever sport I was doing at the time. There was always some sort of trying to one up myself or somebody else. You always want to be the biggest, strongest, fastest, smartest, whatever the case is. So, you know, subconsciously it was always there. Actually putting, you know, modern terms to it and more, you know, OPEX style terms to it, that really started to happen in the Marine Corps. I was in a very unique situation in the Marine Corps when I came in as a Lance Corporal, which is enlisted and an E3 specifically. So the unit that I was attached to was extremely lucky. I was in Hawaii, spent most of my time in Hawaii, and it was an artillery unit, but our parent unit was in Okinawa, Japan. So the way our unit was structured, we had an officer role, an NCO role, and then a junior billet role. And I was fresh out of school, so I was playing the junior billet role. In less than 3 months of joining my unit in Hawaii, the officer transitioned out and was not replaced. So the sergeant that I had was playing the NCO role. He moved into the officer role, and I moved into the NCO role. About 6 months after that, he transitioned out also. His contract was up, didn't renew it. He left. So now me, not even an NCO yet, I was now playing a officer, holding an officer billet, an NCO billet, and the junior billet all for my unit. One of the cool things that I got out of this was I got to fly to Japan a lot where the parent unit was and start attending meetings out there as a junior role, junior employee, essentially. You know, kind of forced into roles that I otherwise was, you know, for lack of better terms, unqualified for. But being a quick learner and definitely eager and willing to do so, I jumped right in and, you know, took the free flights to Japan. And that's really where a lot of this started to kind of play out. Getting some free time on the weekends in Japan and seeing, you know, meeting different people out there. Golf was a part of this as well, how I was meeting people and kind of networking. The first significant memory that I have is likely with the train systems over in Japan, with the what I believe they call the point and call system that they use. You know, learning about that, seeing that, talking to interpreters over there, and kind of getting to informally interview some of the employees with the Japanese train system and learning about what they were doing and why they were doing it was just a mind-opening experience for me. It was really unbelievable to hear them speak of the history of it and the changes that were made and the what happened to be improvements for them and reduction in incidents for them. So learning through that, eventually I read into it a little bit more. You know, New York, their transit system took a version of this and improved dramatically what they were doing as well. And so the Japanese culture itself had a very lasting effect on me that I ultimately carried forward through what I was doing. You know, fast forward a couple of years, I eventually got the NCO role. I was promoted. And through that, I started to take some more ownership. I got a junior Marine underneath me. And that's where I started focusing on the Kaizen and a lot more continuous improvement tools that I can put in my bag now.
And, now, you didn't call it Kaizen at that time, or did you? I mean, when you had this exposure to Japan, did you also have exposure to like the lean thinking or, you know, or the Toyota way? Or did you just start, you know, observing the tools and techniques without the dogma and nomenclature and start just adapting them?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So the nomenclature was there. I was more in observant mode than I was in actual note-taking mode. So through that, the the observations are what led to, self-improvement and self-education and learning more about terminology and nomenclature. Being very eager to kind of pass it down to my junior Marine and eventually Marines, it was early on, I was using the nomenclature, but did not have a proper understanding of it.
Right.
But through enough self-education and then through enough trips over there and talking to senior leaders, I ultimately learned more and how I applied it and over time learned how to apply it, especially to those that were not in a similar role as me, and learned how to speak about it is how I kind of almost like a stealth mode, stealth knowledge you're passing down to people now, because you learn how to talk around certain things that otherwise would have scared them or they would not have understood, and you put it in more of a layman's term, and it definitely helped tremendously, and that's really what I've done since then, especially with Edel Golf. It's how you break it down so people understand it in bite-sized pieces rather than, look at these big words. This is what we're going to do. I think we'll touch on this a little bit deeper into the interview here, but, again, fast forward into Edel Golf. When I took over this role, I had quite a few employees that were senior to me as far as life experience goes. And Six Sigma, Lean, once you start getting into that, we had more of the good old boys that you say terms like that and they kind of shudder right away. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to participate in it. They don't want to do it. So it's a matter of gathering the troops per se and speaking with them, finding that common denominator that everybody can relate to and buy into and believe into. And the more you talk about it as a group, the more you have that open conversation and build that culture around it, the more people are going to believe in it. And when they start voicing their opinions and their thoughts, you can, if you're a very agile leader, you can shift mindsets into that. And before you know it, it's they're doing it without even knowing that they're doing it. Really what I was focused on and really what's helped us grow and be foundationally set the way we are right now.
So I want to get back to the your experience in the Marines. Obviously, you went into the Marines right out of high school, right?
I went to college for 1 year.
Oh, 1 year. Okay.
I was not... going back now, I was a senior in high school when 9/11 happened. And growing up on Long Island, about an hour east of New York City, it's one of those experiences that it definitely hits home. It's close to home.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate in that, no losses within family or friends, but just it being there is super impactful. A lot of friends went and joined the military afterwards, and I went to Plattsburgh. I'm sure you're familiar with Plattsburgh.
Yeah.
I went to Plattsburgh for a year, and I did not go for the correct reasons, I guess we could say. It's I was not mentally prepared for college. I went there to party, and from what I've been told, it's not what college is really for. So,
in retrospect, right?
Yeah. So, hindsight.
But you went in. You went in as an E3. You said.
That's by the time I got to the fleet where I actually got assigned to unit, I was an E3. Okay, I went in. I came out as a PFC, so I was an E2.
Okay. So what I'm wondering here is obviously the Marines must have either done one of two things. Either left you to your own devices, which would be highly unusual, or recognized that you had some sort of leadership skills. Which is why they weren't in a hurry to backfill the people that were leaving, and in fact you were the backfill of the people that were leaving. so they must have recognized some leadership skills. So what were some of your superpowers? Were these things that were taught? Were these things that were just, you know, God's gift to you, combinations thereof? You know, what worked in that as you were developing to be a leader in the Marine Corps?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Really good question. I think there is a natural ability in people to be a leader, but I think there needs to be a lot of teaching behind it as well, a lot of education, and specifically self-education. The Marine Corps is very good in the way it's structured, where obviously you're not just going to walk in and start getting promoted from day one and take over roles. You have to earn each role that you get, and it's done through testing. There is a certain time in service, time in grade piece that gets factored in there, but more often than not, it's coming through recommendations and through senior leadership. I was on a couple of meritorious promotion boards. I was nominated for Marine of the Quarter numerous times, and that's all done through education aspects, your physical fitness testing, a bunch of different factors that go into there, you know, rifle scores, all that good stuff. But you're correct in there is structure behind it to get where you are within your specific rank. For me, before you even go into the Marine Corps, you have to take the ASVAB test. And you ultimately get a military intelligence score, which determines what jobs you're eligible for.
Right.
When I took my test, I scored high enough that I was eligible for every single job. So what I had spoken to with the recruiter was, I want the most challenging job possible. And it wasn't that I was inherently interested in doing chemical warfare, but that was at the time one of the hardest jobs to fill for them. And because I qualified for it, I said, absolutely, let's do this. So when I joined, it was called Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Defense. I don't know, you know, someone changed the name along the lines in the first 4 years that I was in. Perhaps it was somebody who was doing that NBC role, because people used to call it NBC stands for Nobody Cares. That's why you're left on an island all by yourself out there. But that was interesting. We the chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear defense role, it's a constant learning role that you have. It's a constant learning environment. You have to stay up to date. You know, you do get a nice security clearance out of it, but you have to stay up to date of what's going on in the, across the globe, specifically with chemical warfare. This is at the time, 2004 to 2013 that I was in. But we got, when I went to Iraq in 2007, I was hand selected by our battalion commanding officer to play a certain role. And that was specializing in the chemical warfare. And there was 23 of us that were living in the city of Fallujah with the Fallujah Police Department, which had about 600 people. And about 2,000 prisoners all in the same building as us. And that's the same that we were doing stateside. We were doing over there, where it's, you're constantly checking what's going on. Just now you're much more hyper-focused on, this is the area that we need to focus on, what's going on right now, so you could present the situation brief to everybody and get ready for a foot patrol. So
I'm wondering about the, you know, the leadership skills that you developed. I mean, you're actually, you know, leading people. It doesn't sound like you had any formal training per se in, you know, being a leader or leadership development. You know, so did you learn these skills because of, you know, just you had a gut feel of this was the way to do it? Or because, you know, you seem like a very call it a very selfless person. You know what I mean? Somebody that is going to look out for the people that are around them and make sure that they are the best versions of themselves that they can be. But this is not something that is normally just God-given, or I guess it could be. You know, was there anything, you know, was there any mentor or Sherpa that came along and said, listen, Jason, if you want to be a really effective leader, this is the secret sauce for it?
Yeah, there was I can't pinpoint one specific leader. And I think it would, doing so would kind of take away credit from everybody that's crossed my path over the years. I don't have any one individual that's my go-to for everything. I try to, no matter who I meet, regardless of their background, their experience, their current role, and this doesn't matter if it's, you know, in the golf industry, manufacturing industry, or military, whoever I meet, I try to take something away from everybody. Everybody in life that you meet has something to offer. They're a leader in some aspect of their life or their career. And to me, if I can extract that and learn from that and make myself better and in turn make other people around me better, I think that's what makes a good leader. So I think you just have to be conscious of that in life. And if you're conscious of that and able to do that, I think you will become a better leader at the end of the day for it. So whether that's taught, I think there can be a certain portion of that that can be taught. I think you also just have to have it and be aware of it on some degree. Just have the ability to do so and be aware of who you are and what you're, be empathetic is a good way of putting it.
So when you got out of the Marines, did you go directly to EDAL or was there something in between there?
Marriage was the only thing in between there. And you want to talk about operational excellence and efficiency. my wife and I got married, what you call rapidly at this point. We knew each other for 30 days before we got married. It felt right. Ultimately was right. She's absolutely, yeah, it's super efficient. Waste no time. Eliminate all waste.
for me, it was 8 weeks and a day. So you got me beat. You're the first person I ever met that had me beat.
It was 30 days total that we knew each other, and we only spent six of them together, spread over three separate weekends, 2 days each.
Awesomeness.
So she was from Texas originally. I'm from New York originally again. So we got married, and when I was transitioning out of the Marine Corps, I had what we call terminal leave. So I had a certain number of days built up that I can essentially still be under contract with them, collect a paycheck, but I don't have to be with the unit anymore. I can go home now. So through that process, you know, her and I were discussing where do we ultimately want to live? Where do we want to be? And she was very firm in her ways where it was, I am not leaving Texas. My family's here. We're staying here. I said, yeah, you're absolutely correct. We are staying here. So I will be moving shortly. Yes. So that was my transition. I got out, went back to New York, grabbed all my stuff, threw it in my truck, and whatever fit in the truck came on down to Texas. And so life began post Marine Corps.
Well, you know, you had the truck, you know, so Texas was, you're meant for Texas. If you already had,
I fit
truck,
in perfectly.
You were meant for Texas. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
I am more country than I am built for New York.
Awesome. So we're going to take a break, Jason, and, you know, for a couple of messages, and you've been listening to State of Readiness. I'm Joseph Paris, your host, and today's guest is Jason Porcillo. We'll be right back.
This episode of State of Readiness, sponsored by the Operational Excellence Society, a think tank, a creator and aggregator of knowledge and know-how, serving businesses and professionals who wish to learn more on the various topics which combined comprise the discipline of operational excellence. Learn more at www.opexsociety.org.
Welcome back. I'm Joseph Paris, and you're listening to State of Readiness. My guest today is Jason Porcillo, Vice President of Operations at EDAL Golf LLC in Liberty Hill, Texas. You still there, Jason?
I am, Joe, yes.
Awesome. So we've really, you know, brought your whole journey up to the point of you being married and ending up in Texas, throwing all your worldly belongings that could fit into a truck and hightailing it down there. And then once you got there, you came across EDAL Golf. How did that happen?
Right place, right time. The role that I'm in right now was being filled by a former sergeant major in the Army. So having a military background, the commonality there likely helped my case. But I applied for the job online, and he called me in right away. We had a good conversation. I was offered the role. Not this specific role, but I was offered a role with the company, and it fit what I was wanting to do at the time. And just like the Marine Corps, where my role expanded rapidly, I was super fortunate in the sense that shortly after I began with Edel Golf, this gentleman transitioned out, and I threw my hat in the ring and got the role immediately. So, you know, I could not be more fortunate in my entire career, whether it be military or with my current role. Just right place, right time, and a willingness to do so, and showing the aptitude to handle it. So that's
I'm not buying this whole Forrest Gump thing that you got going. All right, okay. I mean, it's not more lucky than smart with you. I'm absolutely convinced of that. Because your civilian career is mirroring your military career. You know, people left that were above you, and you filled that spot. And you know, that doesn't happen by accident. So you must have some superpower, that will give people confidence, in placing you in these leadership roles. And you just don't know what that is.
I think maybe I was just scaring people off, and that they were hitting the road as soon as I stepped in the door. Yeah. No, I think if anything, I would just say it's my ability to relate to people and bring a calmness in the midst of chaos. The ability to handle all situations thrown my way and either properly delegate or just being able to relate and then break it down into I think you referred to it before as a kind of cocktail knowledge, bite-sized pieces of knowledge, and help people grow that way and being there for people. I think as a leader, especially the higher you get in a career or a company, that you need to have a solid foundation and an understanding and experience, whether it's with tools or what have you for your respective industry. You need to have that to succeed, but you need to, as well as the vision, but you need to be able to break it down and make people around you effective. And they're the ones ultimately at the end of the day that are doing quote unquote harder work, the more manual work in our situation. So just having the compassion and empathy to lead them, and you need to want to make them better as well. You can't just throw a task at somebody and walk away and expect, you know, excellence from them. I think there was a sorry for the constant military here, but General McChrystal, he had a great quote that I absolutely love and kind of hold near and dear as far as what leaders are today. And I think it was, hopefully I don't butcher it, but I think it's leaders need to be empathetic crafters of culture. It's not just planning and directing action, but you need to inspire and empower belief. And I think that's really what makes a leader successful is creating that for your entire team, company, whatever role you're in.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, a leader is not a leader because of a rank or a title or riches. A leader is a leader because people are willing to follow. right?
Correct. Absolutely.
You know, so
they can go to you for advice and answers. They can just being very open, exactly, or support.
Yeah.
Just being able to be there for them and that they know and trust and believe in you and that you're doing the right thing for them at all times, regardless of if somebody's watching or not.
And sometimes I think it's important also to just be the person that they want to have as a sounding board. They don't want your input. I mean, they just want to talk to a human being instead of a wall to see if what they say makes sense to themselves. Or they could even talk themselves into finding the solution by having somebody that is just sitting there listening and letting them come to that conclusion themselves.
That's an excellent point right there. Absolutely, 100%. I think that's another aspect of being a good leader is not so much your ability to answer their questions, but being able to listen to them. And you have to know who you're speaking to, and that goes back to empathy. If you're able to properly build that culture of empathy where they're comfortable talking to you, you can also at the same time, if you're agile enough in doing so through conversation, eventually get them to answer their own questions and right. believe in themselves. And before you know it, you just have this absolutely amazing team around you. And I wholeheartedly believe that's what we've done at Adele Golf.
Yeah. Now, it doesn't sound like you were ever tossed into a situation where it was a complete disaster/turnaround situation where, you know, it was chaos, for lack of a better term. It seemed like you went, through several experiences where things were not chaotic, at least to the point of being near broken or broken. Is that a fair assessment?
Not completely. Two examples out of that would be, my two big career moves here. So utter chaos would absolutely be the combat tour that I went on in Fallujah. There was nothing organized about that. It's that's something new and exciting, I guess you can say, every single day, every hour at that. And then Adele Golf, as smooth and efficient as we operate today, we definitely had our kind of growing pains when I first took over this role. And a lot of that was more from an inventory management perspective and even efficiency at that too, the way our floor plan was and the way our current structure and kind of internal ordering system was working out. Without diving too deep into that, we were still, what I like to joke around saying now, we were kind of a step away from a rock and a chisel the way we were doing inventory management, kind of picking up those boxes and shaking them and going, yeah, we should make more of this right now. through kind of the inner nerd in me, I like to build spreadsheets and kind of, again, create calmness out of chaos. So just putting that together and having my talks with the team and getting people to understand what I was doing. And even from a reading perspective, I had encouraged a lot of them to read one of my personal favorite books, The Goal, and getting them to just look at everything from a different perspective, think outside the box a little bit, and understand kind of the foundation of what we're laying without scaring away or choking them with kind of lean or Six Sigma terminology.
Right.
There's been chaotic situations, but again, I think it comes down to the leader as far as how that chaos plays out. If the leader is able to properly digest it themselves and he or she can clear the chaos in their own mind and then calmly explain it to team members, it's not going to show, it's not going to surface, which is ultimately at the end of the day, what's going to make you more efficient.
Awesome. Awesome. So did you have, as you're introducing these and improvement tools and techniques and methodologies, it sounds like you tried to keep the nomenclature colloquial, in their words, not in, not teaching them Japanese. to the extent that you could. Mm-hmm. Did you get any, resistance, overt rebellion or anything like that? And if so, how did you handle it?
For the most part, it was well bought into. Again, going back to kind of the early on when there was a lot of, I'm quote unquote the new sheriff in town, and I have a lot of people that are senior to me in this industry. If you look at it from a manufacturing industry perspective, I didn't have the experience that they had. So there is a certain amount of resistance that was met. But going back to what I touched on earlier about finding a way to be relatable to everybody, it doesn't need to, you don't need to make friends with everybody, but if you can find that common denominator between you and somebody else that you can speak to their understanding, their level, their comfort, you find that happy medium in there to make them better, the company better, and just the operation, the processes that you're building out, much smoother, more efficient. And it, again, like I was just saying before with the leadership, if you can create that calmness, it's really minimal, the negative effects that are out there, or resistance that you might meet. And I think just that ability that I have to do that is really what's helped me be successful in what I've been trying to accomplish with the company and what the company's ultimately accomplished itself and what each individual has grown.
Yeah. I'm going to share with you an anecdote here. Cause I think it's important when you see friction or some, what could be an adversarial situation to find some common ground that you could, start the building of a real relationship. And this is going to go back probably 25 years, maybe a little bit longer. So between 25 and 30 years ago, I was pursuing this opportunity, this project to implement an ERP system at a company. And the IT director was a real, couldn't break through. You know what I mean? You just not sure, engaging. Sure. And, we went out to lunch, and it's in a little tiny town in the middle of no place. So you have a choice of like a diner or McDonald's, which what's the difference, right? So we went to McDonald's and we start talking, and, the subject came up of Seinfeld. And at the time, Kramer was into these Cuban cigars and he was burning down everything. Okay. And we just started talking about Kramer and the Cuban cigars, and we're in tears by the end of lunch. Okay. We're just laughing so hard. All right. And so from that point on, every time we wouldn't say, "Hey, how are you?" We'd see each other and we'd go, "Cubans." All right. That was the thing. And, even since now, 25 years ago, we became pretty good friends. And even now when I go back, since I'm living in Germany, I'll always bring back a Cuban cigar and we'll get together and we'll have a Cuban cigar together.
It's a great point though. I think it's, one of your outside of, operational excellence, I think the most valuable tool that any leader can have is communication. I think people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care about them.
Yeah.
And it's one of those with to be an effective leader, at the heart of effective leadership is a relationship investment. And when you have that, and people start believing into you, your philosophies, your way of doing things, understand your mentality a little bit too, it just builds for a more unified front and a more harmonious working environment.
Yeah, yeah.
Better culture.
I think that that is sometimes people forget, when they're thinking about operational excellence and continuous improvement, it's not about the tools. You know what I mean? It's not about 5S or value stream mapping or Kaizen. At the end of the day, it's only about people. Only.
Absolutely. Okay. 100%. Absolutely.
And I think that those soft skills, when it comes to this discipline, I think those soft skills are not often held in the position that they should be. I think that too many engineers come out thinking about how do I make this operation more efficient, not including the people that are involved in the operation. You know what I mean?
They correct. Just, absolutely.
And they really have to look past the what and the how and think about the why and the people. And I think that is too often not properly attended to.
Yeah, a little bit of that Simon Sinek effect.
Yeah.
I think for me, you know, putting on kind of the hiring manager hat is it's great to see, you know, robust resumes and people possibly, especially at this day and age now with this COVID-19 stuff going on, that there's going to be a lot of people applying for jobs now that are likely overqualified for positions. But at the end of the day, when you finally get that face-to-face or a Zoom interview, I think it's I look for the soft skills more than the hard skills, because I think soft skills are something that people subconsciously have and show in an interview process that otherwise will not be spoken about in a resume. In the hard skills, you can, if the soft skills are there, you can teach the hard skills.
Yeah,
you can train somebody to fit what you're trying to do or right. want to accomplish.
I agree with that 100%. So you ready for the speed round?
Let's do it.
All right. So normal kind of questions here that I usually ask, but the one leader you look up to most and why?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think this kind of goes back to earlier in the interview. I don't have a single go-to that I hold in that high regard. It's not to discredit anybody. I absolutely love everybody that I've come in contact with, friction or not. I take something from everybody that I meet, and I take the positive out of it too. And if there is negative, I try to find ways around that to make it a better relationship. But I think, again, everybody out there, no matter who I meet, is they're better than me at something. And so I try to find what that is and learn from them. And if they are a part of my team, adapt to it. If they are not, at least extract what I learned from them and find a way to apply it down the road. Just put it in a mental note somewhere, a memory bank. And I think on the same side, you know, you shouldn't be afraid to have heroes. But as an individual in your career, you should always be working on becoming your own hero too.
Excellent. So what's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
So I have a couple different ones that I kind of default to. And I think a lot of them are more situation dependent. The number one, and I picked this one up early on in my life. I forget who I got it from, but I guess for you know, podcast purposing here, we're going to call it "Don't Be a Jerk." But it's a different ending to it, is how I was told. But I just think it's another one of those act accordingly and treat others how you want to be treated.
It's about a variant on the golden rule, isn't it?
Exactly, 100%.
You know,
and so yeah, that's a big one for me. Follow that up with never let success get to your head, and never let failure get to your heart. I think that's for me personally. It's another huge one that, you know, remain grounded at all times. Don't forget where you came from, and help others climb their hypothetical ladder that they have in their lives and their careers. A lot of this goes into the continuous improvement, just those words themselves, it's not just a tool for work. That's a life skill. I'm a firm believer in that, that no matter what you're doing, you can get better at it or better at something else. And that's what I want anybody that I come in contact with to understand and believe in themselves. Just so happens that working in manufacturing, it's a great tool to have and a great mindset to be in. And couple the fact that it's not just manufacturing that room, but we're in the golf industry. And if golf is not the ultimate continuous improvement sport, I don't know what is. I would love to hear the argument against it.
That is, I absolutely agree with that.
unless you're sitting there finishing a round of golf with a score of 18 because you made a hole of one in every single hole. And even that, I would argue, is bull crap because that means you didn't touch your putter at all. Yeah. So you still have room for improvement somewhere.
That would be like our dear leader, right? Out there in Kim Jong-un. Would hit an 18, I think. What's a personal habit that contributes to your success?
I think I like this question. For me, having a natural curiosity and having genuine empathy, it's the probably the two greatest factors in all my career success. Again, the continuous improvement, always wanting to get better at everything across the board, a better husband, better father to my two kids, better mentor to coworkers, just trying to get better at all times, and wanting to always learn about something new. I continuously educate myself every corner, every way, whatever it takes, a new book, a new experience. I just think having that has been probably the greatest factor for my career.
Super, super. So the last one, this is a bit of a curveball, but I hope you're ready for it. If you had one do-over, what would it be, why, and what might you do different?
Man, the one redo in life for me, I would have been more willing to make mistakes along the way. I think with mistakes, if you have the mentality, you learn from everything and improve upon it. I think just because of how my career trajectory has worked out, I've been kind of thrust into a lot of roles, and I think I handle them excellently, but I think at the same time, when I was younger, if I'd been more willing to make mistakes rather than ask for forgiveness, I could have built a much deeper pool of knowledge. Not to say that asking for forgiveness hasn't worked out in my favor, but it's
mine too. Yeah. So you had some challenges stepping into uncomfortable situations when you were younger.
Nothing that sticks out in my mind. No. Before the Marine Corps, I was in certain leadership or management roles for the job that I held at the time. I think I would have liked to have learned more the hard way sometimes. And not that I still do that now, but I just think I like watching a lot of this. I learned from my kids now. I have a 5-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old son, and watching them grow and learn. And, part of me has that Marine Corps mentality still, where it's, you're going to get up and do it again. You're going to figure this out the hard way. I'm sure my upbringing was similar to that on some level, but I think rather than just acknowledging the situation, I would have rather gone into it and made mistakes on my own and figured out and learned from them that way. And not to say it would have shaped my career any differently. I think I would have had a bit more different opportunities presented along the way to learn from or apply differently today.
Well, listen, Jason, thanks for that. And thanks for being with me today and sharing some of your insights and wisdom that you've gained along the way. It's been a heck of a ride from my perspective. I'm really, really happy for you. And I got to tell you, working for a golf company is one of my dreams, you know? I love the whole thing, you know what I mean? There's nothing like getting up early in the morning and just going out on the course. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I don't care whatever someone shoots, I don't care what I shoot, just getting up early and getting out there. There's nothing better than that.
My father is in his mid-80s, whenever I go back to visit, weather permitting, usually it's kind of cold in the winter, but weather permitting, we run walk the perimeter of Enjoy Country Club, which is was the home of the BC Open. Now it's the home of the Dick's Open on the Champions Tour. And so we get down there about 7 o'clock, and the outside is where the back nine is, so there's nobody on it. So we just walk the perimeter. But there's nothing like just walking around a course that early in the morning. It just starts the day off right.
So. No, I completely agree. I think at some point we need to find a way to make it happen, Joe, where you and I get out on the course together.
Absolutely.
Next time you're up in New York and I go back and visit family up there.
Well, you never know. I mean, I have a lot of things going on in Texas too. So, yeah, we'll get together one day or one way or another, I'm sure one day. So
love it. I love it.
Thanks a lot for joining. You've been listening to State of Readiness with your host, Joseph Paris. My guest today has been Jason Prokilo, Vice President of Operations at Edel Golf. Thanks a lot, Jason.
Thanks, Joe. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.